On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In her years as a high-profile science writer, Pulitzer Prize winner Natalie Anger has written about polar bears, cheetahs, lions, tigers, and pit vipers. She's written about the science of empathy, altruism, why women's shoes don't fit, why we laugh, why we cry, testosterone, love, and interstellar space travel. Now, Natalie Anger is tying the whole great world of science up in one essential package that just may be your survival kit for this century. Scientific literacy, she says, may now be optional only for losers. Joining me now from Washington is New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Natalie Anger. She's the author of Natural Obsessions and the best-selling Woman and Intimate Geography. Her new book is The Canon, a whirligig tour of the beautiful basics of science. Natalie Anger, thanks very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Before I even open the book, you've got the blurbs jumping out at me and the bullet points. The average adult American today knows less about biology than does the average 10-year-old in the Amazon basin. The average American of 200 years ago knew more. Do we have a problem here, Houston?
We absolutely have a problem here. One of the people that I interviewed, Lucy Jones, who's a geologist at Caltech, said that we are now at a crossroads very similar to the Renaissance, where changing economic conditions then demanded that everybody learn to read and write. It used to be that the priests and people in power could take care of that, and most of the populace was illiterate. All of a sudden, you had to know how to do it just to be able to get a job, to do international trade, to be a member of the merchant class. She says that we are now at that similar kind of crossroads with the world economy that you have to be scientifically and technologically literate in order to really have a future in this particular global community.
But is it true?
Economy.
I mean, do you feel it in your everyday life? We know you do from the way you write about it and everything you investigate, but I can imagine a lot of Americans thinking, well, you know, I hit the auto up button on my car window and it goes up. I hit the, you know, whatever I need, it's there. I hit the button and I've got it. Why do I need to know the science?
It's true. It's one of these ironic things that science, the success of science, has shielded the public from, in a lot of ways, a need to know about science. That in the same way that having maps and GPS systems means that you know, you don't have to know how to navigate anymore. You know, most human beings in traditional cultures, they don't have the luxury of having a bad sense of direction. I mean, they have to get around. That's survival. So in that sense, it has shielded us from the need to know some of these things. But since a lot of our decisions that we're going to make as a society and as individuals are going to rely on having a sense of what's going on, where the new trends are, and to be in the middle of sort of scientific enterprise is really the happening thing. That's going to be the future. That's our economic future. That's going to be the way in which we communicate with each other. I mean, if you ever see some of these old episodes of Star Trek where everybody is very scientifically literate,
right.
I think that that's a reasonable way of looking at the future, that everybody's just going to consider that part of common cocktail chatter.
So there's scientific literacy as a new kind of baseline requirement for success in the same way that reading, that elemental literacy was, what, in the industrial age or even earlier. But in this book, The Canon, you don't just beat us over a stick with the need to become scientifically literate. I love this. At one point you say, I like science. I trust it. It makes me feel optimistic. It adds rigor to my life. Jump in on each of those. Trust, optimism, rigor. Take us to what you mean there.
What I mean is that knowing what I do about the scientific method and how things are done and how scientists work together as this great international community, I trust that if there's fraud, for example, it's going to get found out. If there's something that is questionable, it's gonna be superseded by the next understanding. I read an essay recently, I think it was P.J. O'Rourke, who was talking about how science takes as much of a leap of faith as faith does. Most of us can't read these physics papers, so it's a leap of faith for us to believe it's true. Well, That may be, but the truth is that if you took the time and effort, you could actually find out why the scientists believe what they do. What's the evidence? You know, if you want to take the time, it's there for you to go through. It's not something that you just have to take on faith. Mm.
So there's a civic reason. There's the joy of being able to trust the process that goes into it, and we'll look at that thinking. At the end of the day, though, you say it may not be civic need, but neural greed. I guess that's just the pleasure principle of knowing this stuff.
Yeah, I really, you know, I love science, and I love some of the ideas that have come out of science, and I'm a very idea-driven person. I think that sort of understanding some of the basic concepts of reality, I can't imagine anything more luxurious, more sensual. And so I really go after that. There are many times when I've been writing about science now for more than 25 years.
Right.
And all of us complain about sometimes it's difficult to deal with scientists. They're kind of prima donnas. And you can never please them and on and on. It's like Paris, you know, it's beautiful, but they're the Parisians. But in the end, I come back to it because it is so beautiful. There's so much going on, and it is humanity getting it right for a change, you know. And so much of what we do is kind of fumbling around, catastrophic decisions being made, tearing things down. Science is building up. It's this sort of anabolic process of getting it right. And there's something about that really gives me hope. Right after 9/11, I turned to science to start thinking again in something other than these apocalyptic, sort of gloomy, black thoughts. I said, but there are still all these scientists out there, and they're working away in their labs trying to understand the nature of our universe, the nature of the cell, how things fit together. And they're going at it 24 hours a day, and it's something it's a cooperative process. It also gives you hope that this is a model for how we can cooperate as a species. So there's a lot of reasons to really want to partake of it. Mm. And that's what I try to do, is get everybody to the point where I think everybody can partake of it. And they can't be scientists, but they can have a comfortable, sort of friendly feeling about it that they can then use to follow science as a hobby.
Yeah. And yet, as you remind us, with each passing year, fewer American students opt to study science. Many Americans live in a kind of oblivion to the science that underlies their lifestyle. You're kind of a wizard at waking us up to the wonder of it. When you run into that sort of blank stare about science, where do you begin to point? What story, what anecdote, what thread have you found has been most effective in leading people in, reminding people of how beautiful, wonderful, exciting, luxurious, and sensual, as you put it? You know, what's the big draw?
I try to use an example from my own daily life of what I'm doing at that point, what I'm working on, why I'm excited, why I'm happy. I mean, right now, I'm working on a piece about queen bees, connecting it to the Queen of England. I mean, you know, to understand bee colonies, and not just the fact that all the pollinators are disappearing, which is a kind of a desperate issue we have to deal with, but even looking at social insects and how you have these disseminated decisions going on, you think, well, geez, they know something. They have this kind of hive mind, and so how can we kind of take a lesson from that in our own lives, of this kind of disseminated process of making decisions rather than a hierarchical military structure that we think is the only way to do things, but in fact, the social insects do it very differently, and they're 75% of the insect biomass on Earth. So obviously, this kind of hive mind, this collective consciousness, if you will, is a powerful system for getting things done. So I often try to talk about things I'm working on that excite me. What else can you do? That's the best way to convey excitement, is to feel it.
And in everyday conversation, whether it's with your sister, you write about talking with her in the book, or just with anyone you run into, Americans, let's say, do you, as someone who's so focused on science, sense a kind of fundamental understanding, you know, work at work behind their side of the conversation, or are you reading real ignorance? I mean, we all study science in school.
One of the things that I, as a science writer, do have to keep reminding myself, well, two things. One is, that we're all ignorant of most things. I mean, there are these sort of great canyons of ignorance about history and geography. You know, someone can stump any one of us very easily with asking where a certain river is located. I mean, it just goes on and on. But even saying that, I am sometimes a little surprised at the kinds of things I run into. A quick example of dealing with a copy editor once on a story I was writing about whale genetics, and he stopped me because I, in the course of writing the story, I'd referred to whales as mammals, and he said, "Are whales mammals?" And I kind of stopped short, and I thought, here I am writing this really lovely thing about whale genes and how the different groups are connected is sort of at that level, and he's wondering if they're mammals. So then a little while later, I used the word, instead of using mammals again, I said animals, and he said, "Are mammals animals?" And I said, yes, they are. And in fact, this is just a reminder that you shouldn't sort of go off on some highfalutin thing, that you always have to keep that sense of the ignorance. At the same time, I think that people can really get carried along very far with ideas, that people like to sort of follow the threads of cool ideas, so that you can get pretty sophisticated pretty quickly, as long as you don't assume any prior knowledge.
Natalie, let's take a call, if I may, from Panama City, Florida. Matt's calling. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi. Just curious. I haven't been to college in 15 years, so I'm kind of curious, without going back to college, how do I learn about science like you're talking about? Because most of the time when they talk about science on TV or in the news, they tell you that they're looking for something, but they don't tell you the process or how you can do anything about it. So I'm just curious, how do I learn about science without actually going back to college?
That's wonderful. How to plug back in. What do you say to Matt, Natalie?
I say read my book. One of the things I do try to do in this book is assume that you're an adult who you don't have the luxury of going back and doing it all over again. Mm-hmm. So here are some of the basics. One of the things, as a science writer, I often find myself writing science news, which is, of course, the latest developments, which are built on this huge foundation that perhaps people don't realize, they don't really understand the foundation. So I try to give them the foundation, because then once you have some of these basic concepts, a lot of the science news you come across is going to make a lot more sense. For example, we have the stem cell debate. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that people are not clear on what a cell is and why it's important and why we're built of cells instead of just like sheets of tissue, what it is about the cell that is so fundamental to life. It is the unit of life. So talking about some of that, going back to the basics, talking about what a chemical bond is, what a molecule is, what an atom is, all of these ideas that when you sort of have a comfortable grasp of them, you can follow anything else that comes along. You can ask better questions, and most important, you stop feeling so intimidated. So that's what I try to get at, is some of those the sort of vitamins and minerals of science that allow you to ask whatever you need to ask or to read anything in a general press. I mean, still, I'm not going to say you can go and read something in Physics Review of Letters, but you can certainly follow basic threads more easily when you do have the foundation that you may or may not have gotten in school.
So get the basics and dive back in. And do you find that, I mean, here you're offering it in one volume. It's not even a 10,000-page volume. Do you find once people get plugged back in to the basics, and you're laying it out here, physics, chemistry, evolution, biology, geology, astronomy, can you have a chapter on each of those in maybe your lively style and be equipped to join the conversation, to follow the new developments? Is it enough?
It's a start. I'm not going to make any promises. It sort of condenses a lot of I feel like I have this kind of overall knowledge of the different disciplines, and that they allow me to pursue any particular thread that's going on from there. So these are the things that I've picked up that I see as key to kind of having a toehold in a particular discipline. Whether or not you're going to be able to get into it really in depth, probably that's going to take a lot more work. But how many people really need to be able to do that to really act as though you are a scientist? I think the question is, are you scientifically literate enough as someone like, Al Gore has become? You know, when you hear him give his speech on Inconvenient Truth, you can see that he has mastered a huge amount of material about chemistry, biology, geology, atmospheric science, and he's been able to synthesize that all. And he's kind of a walking example of how you can do that, and you can take pieces of it and put it all together into this better understanding of the world around you.
So dive in with the basics, build from there. Pretty soon you may be more in tune with what you're hearing than you think. Matt, thanks for your call. Let's get another from Newton, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would hope that your listener would deal with the fact that when people talk about evolution, they say it's just a theory. And I think it's important whenever anyone has a soapbox the way you do, Natalie, to tell people how theories are created and tested and evolve. Because theories are important big things that people have been working on for dozens and hundreds of years, not, quotes, just theories.
Just a theory, and we've heard it out there a lot in the last few years. Natalie, you've got the soapbox right now, and Michael's wishing you to make the most of it when it comes to this subject.
I actually do have a soapbox at home, a real one that my husband bought for me so I could get up on.
Up you go.
I'm glad you said that. I talk about that at some length, this idea of what a theory is in science, and that it is not, it is just the opposite of just a theory. When people use that term, just a theory, what they really want to say, if you look at it from a scientist's point, just a hypothesis. This is an idea, a notion I have of how something might work. Now I'm going to go about and design an experiment to test it. But at this point, it's just a hypothesis. And scientists say that all the time. It's just a hypothesis. They don't say it's just a theory, because a theory is, yes, it's something that has great predictive. It's something that's incorporated a huge amount of facts and understanding and observations from many, many different people over the years. In the case of the theory of evolution by natural selection, a huge amount of understanding underlying this umbrella theory that then organizes and makes sense of all of that. It gives it some kind of unifying principle to pull everything together, and then you can use that unified understanding to make predictions. This is what a theory is. It's a huge, powerful, well-founded body of knowledge. It is not just an anything. So I do make the point in the book very, very at some length of the importance of keeping that straight, because, of course, that's used against evolution all the time. Well, it's just a theory. You even say so yourself. You call it a theory. So I wish, in some ways, they had a real jargony term instead of theory, not something that we use in everyday language that would distinguish it. But we have to live with it. It's here. But it helps to really have real respect when you hear that word theory, to really sort of stand up and say, aha, this is something that is big. Mm. It's not just anything.
You write, I'm always surprised, you write, at how often I encounter resistance toward or doubts about Darwinism among otherwise rational people. You spend a lot of time in the book as well on the scientific way of thinking. I mean, maybe it's when we get disconnected from the scientific thought process, then language can skitter all over the place and mean almost anything. What's at the heart of that, of the scientific style of thinking that you champion here, Natalie?
Yeah, every single scientist that I interviewed, they all said the same thing. When I said to ask them, what would you like the public to understand about science? They all said, I mean, it became like my eyes would glaze over. I heard it so often. Mm. Science is not a body of facts. Science is a way of looking at the world. And by thinking of it as a body of facts, then it sort of opens itself up for attack by people who are attacking it for either creationists or other people who may want to attack it as though each fact is somehow fundamental to the existence of science. Mm. Quite the opposite. Science is a way of thinking, and the strength is that, well, two things. One, it isolates things in the environment. When you look around you, you see things, and it's kind of overwhelming, and you say, mm-hmm. I can't make sense of it. They focus in on one item, try to hold that one item steady and change things around it and see what happens to that one variable, and then put that together with other variables. But it's a process of homing in on one specific, one very closely observed detail. And this was driven home to me in the course of reporting the book when a scientist I interviewed at Yale decided that I had to sit there and play this game with him, which I had never heard of, Mastermind. And he had me sit there doing this game, which has little colored pegs, and you're supposed to move the pegs around and focus on one peg at a time and figure out what the other person is doing with his hidden pegs. And okay, I am lousy at games, and I'm sitting there, and I'm starting to cry. I was like sweating. I was starting to cry thinking, he's going to think I'm a real idiot because I'm not very good at this game.
You said, I never really liked games. You're pleading with him.
I said, don't you have a nice slide presentation to show me instead? But actually, it was a good, he said, he had a kind of a military personality. It's like, you're gonna do this, and it's good for you, and I'm making a point here. And in fact, he was, and it did drive home a point to me that idea of focusing in, zeroing in on one element, and trying to keep that steady while things change around it. So that way, you have the strength of what some people call reductionism, but that, of course, is science. And the other thing that's so critical is uncertainty about things. Scientists say they're not looking to get a result. They're looking to get the error bar around the result. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing that they feel most confident in is when they're working on what is the error bar. And in fact, you want to get it as narrow as possible.
It is the margin of uncertainty, the margin of unknowable or unknown.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives science its strength, because it also gives it an adaptability, and you can start to see that, you know, this is why science is always evolving and able to change, is that it's not fixed at any point. There's this error bar, this kind of almost like a Gumby doll thing around it. And so that is what science is. And the uncertainty of it is a surprising amount of strength of it. So it's hard for people to think that, because, of course, we do want answers. But why is it not going to ever happen? It's probably fundamental to reality. I mean, everybody's heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And that's kind of on a larger scale. That's what we're saying about studying life, that you can never be certain about anything.
So there's a kind of discipline in it, with that tight focus attached at the same time to an acceptance of uncertainty and a systematic way of gauging that uncertainty. You've been thinking about and writing about science for a long time. We live in a society saturated and underpinned with science at just about every turn. So is our popular culture now more or less in tune with the scientific thinking that undergirds so much of our technology, our daily lives?
It's a sort of funny kind of sort of Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, there's, on the one hand, we're all techie these days, and of course everybody, I mean, my daughter's in fifth grade, and she comes home with new jargon terms all the time that she's being taught at school. You know, they like to have abbreviations and so on. I think that that's part of our society, but I kind of think of the movie Star Wars, where they had, on the one hand, kind of amazing futuristic stuff. On the other hand, half the time you're in this primeval sort of tropical rainforest with everything sort of dripping in the sense of the ancientness of it. So you have this sense of both the futuristic, and yet there's this kind of fairy tale quality too. And in some ways, people are kind of like that. We have a lot of technology around us, and yet there's still a lot of, magical thinking and, this kind of belief in fairies and that kind of the Harry Potter desire we might have for things. That the truth is that the universe is a place of a lot of amazing stuff. But as Steven Weinberg, a physicist, said, it's a place where, you know, certain things don't happen. And so we have a pretty good sense of how the universe works, and chances are, you know, this broomstick is not going to just sort of pick up and fly off and take you up into the sky. I mean, there's a certain limit to how much magic there is in the universe. it's a sensible place in some ways, and that I think that makes it, the fact that it is knowable, the fact that the universe is knowable at all, as Brian Greene said, is an amazing thing. It didn't have to be knowable, but it is.
With our deeply corrugated brains applied to it, and thank heavens for it. Let's get a call from Richmond, Virginia. Kevin, you're on the air with Natalie Anger.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
I have a question, and obviously along the lines of what you're talking about, it sounds like science, and obviously the scientific method of thinking is very much, it is based on fact, and it's kind of devoid of emotion. I'm just wondering, because obviously the lay person, especially in this day and age where we want people to be more scientific, to kind of lend themselves to the environment and that sort of thing, in talking to the lay people, it seems as if people are prone naturally to anthropomorphism and adding human qualities to things so that they can identify it with it, love it, save it, etc.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering, do you find that that is a positive thing, negative thing, or does it really matter in this day and age?
Natalie, does it look too cold? Do people, if they can't anthropomorphize it, they don't want it?
Well, I can understand that because I've been a really incorrigible anthropomorphizer myself. I anthropomorphize molecules. You know, I can't help but think of everything as a character in a drama. Is that necessarily a bad thing, though? Does this impede our understanding? Well, I don't think so. I mean, as long as you don't start to superimpose that on anything, if you kind of have some feelings, if you attach an emotional component to what you're looking at, and this is a big debate now among biologists who study animal behavior, is anthropomorphism this great crime? Is it a sin? Or is it actually a wedge into understanding what's really going on? I think that it has to be done very carefully and with great self-awareness. We shouldn't impute purpose into things so often. One of the things I talk about in a chapter on probabilities is how often we start to see patterns and we start to see portentous signs. And if you go through certain exercises, as some of the people I talk to, statistics professors who take their introductory students through these exercises of seeing how often patterns arise just randomly, and you start to see all sorts of things happening, clusters happening. And in fact, if you don't have the clustering, then you know there's actually a human design behind that.
Let's take a call from Yorktown, Virginia. Pat, you're on the air with Natalie Anger.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a couple of points. First, number one, you mentioned something earlier about when did that light or that spark first come that got somebody interested in science? How can we do that for people?
Mm.
Well, myself, it came when I was in high school, and I had been taking math all throughout school before that, and it was just rote memorization, drills, et cetera, and didn't seem to have a whole lot of, other than counting things, any use. Well, then I had chemistry, and all of a sudden, all of that mathematics that I've been having all that time suddenly connected with the touch, feel, see, smell world, and the huge light bulb just came on, and then I, from then on, I just couldn't get enough mathematics, and I think that we select people out of some of these courses, i.e. biology, et cetera, until later in high school, when they could probably start some of these advanced tie-in courses earlier.
Plug in and make it real. Pat, make it real for us. My little note here says you did chemistry for the Army for 3 years. What kind of chemistry did your enthusiasm take you into?
I was an environmental chemist. I was the Army's version of the EPA.
So watch out for the chemical footprint we're leaving, in other words.
Exactly. That was it. We were the watchdogs. The Army does have a rather aggressive program. They're derided quite often on their past, but their present and future is much better than it used to be.
Boy, we love to hear that, and we love the enthusiasm that got sparked in you that put you there. Natalie, what do you say? Pat says, you know, make it material, make it real, and you'll find that enthusiasm. He found it with the chemistry set.
Yes, well, unfortunately, chemistry sets today are they're more like kind of cooking kits, from what I understand. They used to be back when the baby boomers were kids, you could actually make boom. I mean, you could make explosions. You can make very toxic things. You can make these wonderful bubbling colors. I mean, it was a much more of an exciting process.
Well,
now.
But I simplify too much, because he's really saying with chemistry class, when it became material in that way and not just numbers,
yes,
on the page.
Exactly. I think that doing hands-on science is what turns on everyone who goes into science. Is they had a class where they actually were doing experiments, and this, of course, is something that everybody should be doing. I remember that reading about Primo Levi. It was he said he felt sorry. He was a chemist. I mean, he was a beautiful writer, but he was a chemist up to the end. He said he felt sorry for people who didn't have a lab where they could go and play. And there is a sense in which it is play, and there is nothing better than doing experiments. Scientists love doing them. I wish more people did them. I know that I've seen when they take high school students to a lab and have the students doing experiments, boy, then you've got 25 budding scientists there. But if you're just looking at it and memorizing a lot of terms for the exam, then you've got 25 people who are going to say they flunked high school chemistry and they hate it. So, yes, this is a way to do it. And also, I recommend to people that, you know, there are actually a lot of labs around. There are a lot of scientists working, just even in local, you know, in city, in your state government, in companies. And a lot of times people don't realize that they can go on tours and watch some of this work being done. And, you know, just getting a feel for it. It's a shame that people hardly ever run into scientists. You know, they'll go to a cocktail party, you meet a lawyer, you'll meet a businessman. But, you know, how often do you meet a scientist? So the thing to do is to go out and maybe see what's going on at a lab. That will get you excited, too. Do your own experiments. I mean, there's so many websites that can take people through that. I know that when I was writing something about the equinox, took my globe out and put it in the way that was described to me by the people at the Exploratorium, so I could see half of my just desktop globe was in shadow and half of it was in light. Just, you know, and you go
get
and
out
say,
the
hey,
flashlight,
cool.
Get out the globe, and you're plugged in.
Yeah, go out at night, watch the moon for every night for a week and watch where it is and when it rises. And when you start to do that, it's like you become much more connected to your universe that way.
Pat, we love that you're out there doing it, or we're doing it for the Army on the Environment. That's great. Thanks for calling. Let me take a call from Washington, D.C. John, you're on the air.
Hi there. I want to offer this comment, which is really based on my own experience working on a research project which compared science curriculums, one of which emphasized the scientific method, and then another which really emphasized, which helped students along a lot more in the way we've learned to do in the other disciplines, in the way that in the way that we've learned to do in education department,
yeah,
at the university. What we found was there's evidence to suggest that we really can't rely on the belief that the scientific method alone is going to help students become more scientifically literate. That we also, that they're...
Well, because they don't get it, or because they're not turned on by it, because it doesn't grip them? Why?
Well, it's not that it doesn't grip them, though it may not. It's that, you know, if they run an experiment, they may not know what to be looking for, and the question on the paper will just read, and what did you observe the car do, or, you know, what did you observe the solution do? And they're not quite sure what the next step is. They sort of need, forgive me for using this word, that sort of scaffolding that you don't get with the scientific method.
And what does that look like? Cartoon drawings on the page, or a video game, or what was your conclusion, John?
Oh, no. Well, the conclusions really, they were made at a pay grade higher than my own. But no, I mean the students were all very competent. No cartoon drawings on the page, but you could tell that one set of students did perform better, and they were more scientifically literate, so to speak, working on the curriculums that were not that sort of scientific fundamentalism.
John, we've got it, and we've got Natalie Andrew, who's kind of the reigning master of popularizing and making the scientific method seem anything but dry. Natalie, what is your sense of how most things get taught in school? I mean, you look at it as someone who popularizes and interprets all the time. Could we do better at that level in our actual education system?
Oh, yes. I think everybody agrees that we need to improve our education. You know, I'm not a big fan of the term scientific method. It sounds somehow very dusty and off-putting and also sounds very rigid. I think one of the things that scientists struggle with throughout their careers, but it's what makes it fun for them, is designing a good experiment because, you know, there are many different ways to approach a problem, but what you want to do is you want to design an experiment where you're likely to get interpretable results. So they spend a lot of time. That's like, to them, the creative, fun, but also very difficult part of doing their work is coming up with a good experiment. It's not easy, but one of the things I think teachers have to do in helping students is to look at their experiments, their proposed experiments, and help them to focus it and help them to really think through what exactly it is you're trying to find there, because it can be something too vague and you'll never get any, you won't get an answer that will be interpretable or something that you can build on. So designing and streamlining experiment is key to a good science class, and that's something that people need a lot of help with, especially during their education, but even later when they're still working on science. Why do you think scientists go to conferences all the time? I mean, they're basically talking about ways to design experiments where they will get interpretable results. Mm. It's not straightforward, and it doesn't come out of the air.
David's calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hello. My brother, who is a physicist out of Berkeley and MIT,
yeah,
gave me a wonderful insight into science a few years ago. We were talking about creationism as an alternative to evolution.
Mm.
And he said, to me, it's not science if there isn't a way to prove that it is false.
Right.
In other words, he meant that scientists are not a bunch of know-it-alls. They're a bunch of test-it-alls.
Right. Test it, and if you can't possibly prove it false. Natalie, what do you say? The key there, seeing that vulnerability to proof?
Falsifiability, yeah, that's one of the key principles there. It is true that, you know, you can never prove that something is, you can't prove that something is true. What you can do is you try to eliminate all the competing explanations for it. So you are trying to falsify your result. You're trying to say, okay, I got this result, and here's different ways to interpret it. I'm going to try to do further experiments to eliminate this, that, and the other interpretation of this result. Falsifiability is key. But mostly, one of the things that's also key to science is having, you know, the control group. This is so, so important. This is why anecdotes that you have, medical anecdotes, cures that you get from a particular product, and you don't have a good control group for it. Science is not just, you know, evidence is not just a kind of a lot of anecdotes strung together. Mm-hmm. Evidence is actually having a control and falsifying and eliminating possibilities and ending up, okay, well, this is by default, this is the best interpretation we can give for the moment. But that is key to science. And yes, it's true. I mean, how can you falsify some of the claims made by creationists on things like, I mean, if you're just going to say it's a miracle, there's not much you can do with that. So it isn't science.
Science has trouble with that one. We've got a question on just that front. Bill in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'd have to say first that one of the things that got me interested in science and math at the outset were relationships with people who I would call mentors now. And I'm not sure that a lot of people in schools are mentoring and encouraging people. Also, I agree with you that the scientific method, as it's taught, is sort of dull compared to the way people think when they study science and engineering and math. It's a way of looking at the world. And in that regard, there's been a lot in the news about evolution and DNA and medicine and religion versus what I would call enlightenment, since so much science started at during the Age of Enlightenment. I was wondering if you, what sort of reactions you have in dealing with the people who feel that you shouldn't try to think about things and understand how they work, and that you should only have faith and not even think about it.
The political and cultural climate that we may be in some dimension right now. Natalie, how about it?
Well, I think that, you know, if people want to have, I personally am an outed atheist. I've written about this. I don't see where there's any evidence to be otherwise. But if people have a strong sense that there's something there and there's some abiding intelligence, that's fine. But let's understand reality as it is, not as we wish it could be, and not as, you know, some 2,000-year-old book says it. Let's understand reality as it is. And I think that a lot of scientists I know who are still religious feel perfectly comfortable with that kind of dichotomy in their lives between their faith and just trying to understand reality. And the tools of science have been so powerful. The fact that just by studying light beams reaching us from distant stars, and that's all astronomy is looking at light beams, we've been able to figure out the amazing, you know, the whole contours and architecture of the universe, approximately how many stars are out there, the structure of things. There are big mysteries that remain. Dark energy, everyone's heard of. Yes, there are mysteries that remain, but we've learned so much. And by looking at things in this way, where you're sort of taking it one step at a time, that is so powerful. And, you know, that we can know that the Big Bang happened about 13.4 billion years ago. This is very powerful stuff.
And a flag, you're clearly going to keep flying. Let me get one more call from Neil in Fall River, Massachusetts. Neil, you're on the air.
Tom,
hey.
How you doing?
All right, what do you know?
Tom, I'm going through the Enlightenment right now as we speak.
Oh, yeah?
I was an English major 20 years ago in college, and I became a woodworker, builder, and, you know, manufacturing, it's not working out, so I'm back in college. I'm on my way now to class. And I'm becoming a BMW tech, so I'm all over science now. Air waves, high pressure, low pressure, how air conditioners work. And the beauty, Tom, is that once it's like fascinating, you can relate this air pressure and foils to airplanes, but you can also get into understanding how curveballs work. It's just a wonderful thing.
You got the bug, man.
Tom, the thread here I want to leave you with is that if you're going at it like I'm going at it, you don't need to know you don't have to do all the math. You can just understand the concept. When somebody comes in with a car and says, I'm hearing this whistling sound at a certain speed, all you really have to understand is frequency, air, what makes noise. You don't have to be able to figure out all the mathematics.
Neil, we love it. You're on fire. You're on fire with it. Good luck. Yeah. Get to class. Soak it up and fix my car when you're done with it. I want you on my car's case. That's great. Neil, thanks for calling. Natalie, there's the excitement right there of somebody who's in it up to his neck.
Yeah, and he makes the point that it's all connected, too. You can apply this understanding to a different situation. The pieces fit together. It's a very modular universe we live in, so it helps to understand the basic components of it.
Yeah, and you keep that flag right up there, and we're so grateful for that. The response you're getting so far to the book, Natalie, do you see people wanting to dive in on this? Do Americans still have that scientific Jones?
I think that there is a growing desire to understand about science, and maybe the whole concerns over the environment are helping to fuel that. But I think we're maybe turning a corner away from the sort of new dark ages and into the new enlightenment.
Natalie Anger's new book is The Canon. Natalie, thank you so much for being with us today.
And I very much enjoyed it. Thank you.
We'll go out with She Blinded Me with Science. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.